But the key point to this argument actually isn't even just to say that Jesus is Lord. It's just saying you cannot say that he's just a great moral teacher and then ignore his claims to divinity. He says, don't let us come with any of that patronizing nonsense.
Hi, I'm John DeRosa, and you're listening to the Classical Theism Podcast, where we defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation and love the God of classical theism with all of our heart and all of our mind. Welcome back to the Classical Theism Podcast, where we glorify the God of classical theism and defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. Here at the Classical Theism Podcast, we aim to defend three core pillars of the Catholic Christian worldview. One, that the God of classical theism exists. Two, that Jesus is our Lord and Messiah. And three, that he founded the Catholic Church. And today we're going to be talking about a writer, a very, very important writer in the 20th century, C.S. Lewis. And I'm bringing on David Bates, who's going to tell us, why should we read C.S. Lewis? And what does he have to say by way of argumentation for the pillars of our faith? Particularly, I'm going to ask David, what kind of arguments for the existence of God can we find in Lewis, and where can we find them? Also, what evidence does he provide for Christianity? What does he have to say along those lines? And I'm also going to press him on, hey, do you think he would have been a classical theist? What evidence do you have to back that up? And I think you're going to find that even though C.S. Lewis wasn't Catholic, David Bates is going to make a compelling case for why we should know about him and why we should read him. So without further ado, here's the interview. I'm joined by David Bates, an English software engineer living in the United States. He was raised Catholic, but fell away for a time period of several years when he explored various non-Catholic Christian congregations. He returned wholeheartedly to Catholicism, writing about the faith at restlesspilgrim.net and traveling around the country giving talks on scripture, church history, evangelism, and apologetics. He also hosts a weekly podcast, Pints with Jack, where he and his co-host work chapter by chapter through the works of C.S. Lewis. David Bates, welcome to the Classical Theism Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
David, today we're discussing the apologetics of C.S. Lewis, but how did you first become interested in C.S. Lewis? Tell us that story.
Well, like many people, my introduction to Lewis was through the Chronicles of Narnia. My parents primarily used them as bribery. If I had washed my face, brushed my teeth, got into my pajamas, and was in bed on time, then I'd be treated to a chapter of the Chronicles of Narnia. And my love for Narnia really grew during my childhood. I had this big push-along plastic lion who I inevitably called Aslan. But I don't think I really read any more Lewis after about the age of 12. It was then when I was in my mid-20s, I was babysitting for a family from church. Their parents were teaching a course at our church. And so for a couple of months, once a week, I would look after their children. And not quite knowing what to do with them, I just did what my parents did with me. I used the Chronicles of Narnia as bribery to get them all ready for bed on time. And so if they were all ready for bed, then I would treat them to a chapter of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. With voices. And reading that to the kids, it really reignited my love for Narnia. And so after that period of babysitting came to an end, I bought the box set and I read the rest of the books again. And rereading them as an adult, I started to see the deeper meaning behind the books and the Christian motifs, which Lewis really expertly weaves throughout. And then after I finished Narnia, I started reading his explicitly Christian works, things like Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, The Screwtape Letters, and The Great Divorce. And then fast forward a little bit to a couple of years ago when I met Matt at a party. We met and we started talking, and I naturally started talking about C.S. Lewis because I'm really fun at parties and that's the sort of thing that I do. And I discovered in Matt something of a kindred spirit. It actually puts me in mind of something that Lewis wrote in The Four Loves. He said that friendship is born in a moment when one person says to another, "What, you too? I thought I was the only one." And I had said for ages that I'd wanted to start a C.S. Lewis reading group here in San Diego. And now that I'd met Matt, I realized even if it was just the two of us, sitting over a beer or a coffee, discussing some chapters of Lewis. That would be a really great thing to do once a month. And so we started a book club here in San Diego, and other people did also join. But after a few months, we also decided to start the podcast, Pints with Jack. And that was for a couple of reasons. One was that people from outside of San Diego heard about the book club and asked if they could be involved somehow, if I could set up a webcam at our meetings. And that just seemed far too complicated. So we thought a podcast might be a good alternative. And also it would allow us to go deeper, as you say, chapter by chapter. Because when you've got, even in the best of groups, when you've got a number of people and you're discussing several chapters, you have to keep things at a reasonably high level. Whereas when you've got a half hour, 45 minute podcast, you can go far deeper. And Matt and I, we often say that we're enthusiasts, not experts. We see our job as really just trying to help people crack open Lewis and then actually read him for themselves.
I love it. And we're going to be diving into the apologetics of C.S. Lewis, but I'm going to encourage listeners to check out your podcast, to go into Lewis more deeply than they have before. But some, David, you know this, some people might just think C.S. Lewis was a clever fiction writer who dabbled in amateur philosophy. But I want to hear some more from you. Who was C.S. Lewis, and why should we take his work seriously?
Yeah, well, as you say, for a significant group of people, C.S. Lewis is just simply the guy that wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, some kids' books. But that's simply one element of an incredibly versatile writer. And I would also argue he also had a really fascinating life. And I think it's good if we can take a little bit of time now just to look at his life, because it explains his apologetics so well, and it gives us some context for his embrace of atheism and his eventual return to God.
Let's do it.
So he speaks about his life and his spiritual journey in his spiritual autobiography, a book called Surprised by Joy. And he was born in 1898 in Belfast. And although he was baptized Clive Staples Lewis, that's what the CS stands for, from a very early age, he stubbornly refused to respond to any name other than Jack. And that became his nickname for his entire life. And Jack's childhood was marked by him being a real voracious reader and having a very active imagination. But a shadow was very quickly cast on his childhood through the loss of his mother to cancer when he was just 9 years old. And his miseries compounded when he was then sent to boarding school in England, which he really hated. But his education eventually turned around when his father sent him to a man called William Kirkpatrick. Now, at this point, Lewis was a confirmed atheist. He had embraced atheism for a number of reasons, but two are probably worth mentioning. The first was when he encountered the pagan classics. He saw some similarities with Christianity, and he reasoned, well, if the pagan classics are false, why would Christianity be true? Why would the God of the Bible be any more real than the gods of Olympus? And another thing that really pushed him in this direction was the problem of pain that he saw in the world. He would actually quote the Epicurean poet Lucretius, who said, had God designed the world, it would not be a world so frail and faulty as we see. So he already came to Kirkpatrick as an atheist, but his tutor's rigorous training in logic really hardened his atheistic position. But he also flourished academically, and he won a place at Oxford University. But he was about to be dealt some more bad luck because the Great War, World War II, broke out. And so Lewis enlisted, and he arrived at the front line in France on, get this, his 19th birthday. That was his birthday present.
Wow.
But he survived the war, and he then returned to Oxford and completed his education. And he got several degrees. Guy was crazy smart. He did it in Greek and Latin literature, philosophy and ancient history, and English. And he was then appointed to teach at Oxford as a tutor of English. He then settled in the area, and he bought the Kilns, which is this house on the outskirts of Oxford. And I actually got to visit it about a year ago. And he lived there with his brother, Warney. They were very close. And as well as Janie and Maureen Moore. And these were the mother and sister of someone that Lewis had trained with when he was preparing to go to war. And they had agreed that if one of them died, the other would take care of that man's family. And that's exactly what Lewis did. He looked after them for the rest of his life. But while he's at Oxford, this is when his worldview goes through considerable development. He starts seeing the flaws with his naturalism, with his atheism, and then he first becomes a theist, and then a little later then becomes a Christian. And in Surprised by Joy, he identifies some of the things that started pushing him in this direction. And he said one of them was that his books started turning against him. He realized that all of his favorite authors, George MacDonald, G.K. Chesterton, they were all Christians. Whereas those authors with whom he should be more philosophically aligned, people like George Bernard Shaw, Voltaire, he just found that they were lacking, they lacked substance. And not only were his books turning against him, his circle of friends was being invaded by supernaturalists, particularly Christians. And it's here that Lewis becomes friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings. And if any of your listeners are fans of Lord of the Rings, they can thank Lewis, because it was Jack. He was Tolkien's primary audience for years, and he was the one who pushed him to finish it, because Tolkien was a bit of a procrastinator and a bit of a perfectionist. But Lewis pushed him to finish it, and he helped him get it published. But together they formed the Inklings, which was a literary discussion group, which would meet sometimes in Lewis's rooms at the university and sometimes in the Eagle and Child pub, which is affectionately known by locals as the Bird and Baby. And I actually got to have a pint in there about 2 weeks ago. Lots of great pubs in Oxford if anybody wants to visit. So his books turned against him. He became friends with many, many Christians. But one other thing that started pushing him away from atheism. Earlier I said he rejected God partially because of the injustice that he saw in the world, the problem of pain. But he would later write that he started now seeing a problem with that. He said that his argument against God was the fact that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But he realized, where had he been getting this idea of just and unjust? He says that a man doesn't call a line crooked unless he's got an idea of what a straight line is. And he asked himself, to what was he comparing the universe when he called it unjust? And anybody trained in philosophy is starting to see the direction that this is starting to point in, that you need some transcendent goodness to which to compare. And so he converts to theism, first of all. And his account in Surprised by Joy is both moving and I think a little amusing, because he says, you must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen College night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. And that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. He then later converted to Christianity, and this was aided through a long late night conversation that he had with Tolkien and another Inkling, Hugo Dyson. I said that Lewis had already, he'd always regarded Christianity as a myth. But what Tolkien and Dyson helped him see is that the other myths were man's faltering attempt to find God. And Christianity itself was the true myth, in that it actually happened. It was myth that had become fact. And then over the following years, he became a very well-known Christian speaker. During World War II, he had addressed the nation on BBC radio. And these talks were eventually collected together to form what is probably Lewis's most famous apologetic work, Mere Christianity. But that wasn't the only thing that he wrote. In addition to apologetics, he wrote works of literary criticism and fiction. He produced over 30 books, I would say. And one in particular brought him a lot of fame, and that was the Screwtape Letters, particularly here in the United States. And if your listeners haven't read it, it's a fictional correspondence between two demons who are discussing how to tempt a particular human. And it's a fantastic work, not only of theology, but also psychology. And the book was so popular that it actually put Lewis on the cover of Time magazine. And as a result of this fame, he had an avalanche of mail. And he diligently responded to all the letters he received, both from children and adults. And you can find collections of these letters, and they are delightful and very clearly thought out. And it was actually through a letter that he met his future wife, Joy Davidman. So Lewis was an incredibly smart guy, but he wasn't just an academic. He was a very practical man, particularly when it came to his faith. He thought that charity was very important, and he founded the Agape Fund, through which he anonymously gave about two-thirds of his royalties. And despite the fact he was one of the most famous authors in England at the time and one of the most popular speakers, he lived very frugally. And then his life came to a tragic end. He was only 64. He died on November 22nd in 1963, which was the same day that JFK and Aldous Huxley died. So that gives you a little overview of a very interesting life. But you ask, why pay attention to him? And I would say it's because Lewis was someone who'd previously been very influenced by the zeitgeist through the spirit of the age. He'd come to embrace atheistic materialism and found it both intellectually and imaginatively lacking. And in pursuing truth, he came first to God and to the gospel. And during his life, through his speaking, through his writing, he led many other people along that same path. And I think we need to hear that. And as I'm hopefully communicating through my enthusiasm for Lewis, I just think he was brilliant. He was such a diverse writer. And in particular, he understood the power of story. A lot of people dismiss his fiction and the Chronicles of Narnia as children's books. But Lewis knew how works like that, laced with Christian ideas, that they could steal past the watchful dragons of prejudice. And through those works, he engaged both the head and the heart, the reason and also the imagination. And so for that, and I think many other reasons, I would say he was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Christian apologists of the 20th century.
Wow, David, I am so happy that I just gave you space to lay that out, because that was an awesome recap of C.S. Lewis, his life, his work, and why we should take it seriously. I think I'm going to have to cut that clip, just of that like 8 or 9 minutes there, and just have it for people to see, because who can hear that story and not want to read Lewis? That's what I want to encourage. And we're going to go into the apologetics. We're going to get into some of the philosophy. But I think anyone who was listening, you speak about him, can sense your enthusiasm. And honestly, I'm feeling a bit convicted myself, because I've read some of his philosophy. Personally, I have not read the Narnia series, and I have not read a lot of his other works. But just hearing all that makes me want to dive into it. Before we get to the apologetics, though, one more question about Lewis. I know you mentioned his interactions with Tolkien. What other Christian writers or just philosophers had an influence on him?
Well, Lewis tells us many of these in Surprised by Joy. And fortunately for us, there was also a magazine article in The Christian Century where he was asked this very question. And just as an aside before we get to the answers that he gave, Lewis was always a fanatical reader, but he also had an incredible memory. He would play a game with his students sometimes. He would say, pick a number. And he said, okay, go to that numbered shelf in my office. Okay, pick another number. Okay, go to that numbered book. Pick another number. Okay, go to that numbered page. And he would have the student read the first sentence, and then he would complete the rest of the page from memory.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
His brother Warney apparently said that sometimes he would just memorize a book so he didn't have to buy it. But what did he read? It's an eclectic mix. I've alluded to the fact that he dove deeply into the pagan classics, but he also read St. Augustine, Dante Alighieri, so particularly his Divine Comedy. He loved his Divine Comedy. Boethius, the 6th century philosopher, played a big part in his thinking. Also authors like Milton, John Bunyan, and I also mentioned earlier G.K. Chesterton. Lewis said that when he read The Everlasting Man, it was the first time he saw the whole Christian outline of history set out in a form that made sense to him. Another really important author was George MacDonald. When Lewis read his book Fantasties, and MacDonald, he wrote theology, but he also wrote fairy tales. He was really a pioneer in that area. And Lewis said that when he read Fantasties, it baptized his imagination. Mm. Remember earlier I said with Narnia that it can get past the watchful dragons. Well, that's one of the things that Fantasties started to do inside Lewis before he started wrestling with the rational reasons for accepting or rejecting God and Christianity. But also as a he read a lot of Catholic books, Thomas a Kempis, Francis de Sales, The Imitation of Christ, Introduction to the Devout Life. He loved those books. And as we mentioned, his friends, the Inklings, Tolkien, Charles Williams, he was good friends with Dorothy Sayers as well, and Owen Barfield. One of the things that Barfield helped him see was what Lewis would later refer to as chronological snobbery. The idea that if an idea is old, well, then it's out of date. If an idea is new, then it's fresh and modern. And he started seeing the foolishness in that.
Well, that's a great list of philosophers, of Christian writers, of, you know, fiction writers that influenced him. I can't believe that story about his memory, though. He was just, oh my gosh, absolutely incredible. But here, I want to get into the apologetics, though, David, because here at the Classical Theism Podcast, we defend three pillars of the Catholic Christian worldview. One, that God exists. Two, that Jesus is Lord. And three, that he founded the Catholic Church. And despite the fact that Lewis was not a Catholic, you mentioned he read a lot of Catholics. I also think he had a lot of apologetic material that would be very useful for our Catholic apologetics enterprise. So first, let's talk about the existence of God. What did Lewis write that would help us defend God's existence? What were some of his contributions in this area? Where can they be found? Take us through some of those details.
So the books where he really talks about this sort of thing is his autobiography, which I mentioned a bunch of times now, Surprised by Joy, Mere Christianity, which was the collection of those radio talks he did during World War II, The Problem of Pain, and Miracles. And if people are looking just for a brief introduction to Lewis's apologetics, I'd actually really recommend a book by Professor Lewis Marcos. It's called Apologetics for the 21st Century. And there he goes through some of the major apologists that we've had, and Lewis is one of them, and he pulls apart some of the things that Lewis argued across his works. But probably one thing that's worth saying is Lewis stood on the shoulders of others. It wasn't that he just came up with these brand new arguments. But what Lewis did do is he popularized them. He was a very, very good communicator. And one thing that you hear very often from people for whom Lewis has played a big role in their faith journey, they'll say that when they read Lewis, they realized that their faith had a rational defense to it. It was reasonable. And Lewis even says in Mere Christianity, he says, I'm not asking anybody to accept Christianity if their best reasoning says that the weight of evidence is against it. He says, no, that's just silly. And he actually spends a little while talking about what faith is, because so often we're told that, oh, faith is just believing something where there's no evidence. Lewis says, no, that's not what faith is. He views it more in terms of faith is holding on to what your intellect has come to believe based on the weight of evidence when your emotions take a blitz of your intellect. The example I like to give is, well, about 10 years ago when I was young and stupid, I went skydiving. And I had done some research before and I found out, no, skydiving is very safe. And the school that I'm going to, they have a very good record. So intellectually, I know all of this was very good. But when I was standing at the door to the plane with the earth a long way down, my intellect did not help me. My emotion was screaming at me that this was a terrible, terrible idea. And so that's how Lewis understood faith. Faith is hanging on to what your intellect has concluded when your emotions want to tell you something else, and your passions in particular. Because he says that if you try and be a Christian, and even if you try and be good, there will come a point when it will be very convenient for you to brush those things aside. So that's what he regarded faith as, but it was based on reason. And he had a number of different arguments that he used. So I'll just pick a couple of them. First one is the argument from desire. And this was Lewis's favorite, and it's mine too. It doesn't have quite the, particularly in this form, it doesn't have quite the rigor of one of Thomas's five ways. But it just convicts me. He wrote about this in Mere Christianity, in a chapter about hope. And he says, how do we respond to when the world lets us down? When the things in our lives, they're just not quite as good. They don't give us quite the joy that we thought that they would give us. And he says that you can go down the route of just trying to find new and greater versions. You know, your marriage isn't happy, go and find a better wife, better car, better house, get newer, better, get more. And he says that man's going to be miserable. Or you could go the Stoic route, just accepting the fact that life is disappointment. Or that was it in The Princess Bride, life is pain, Highness. But he says that the Christian responds differently. He says that creatures aren't born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires actually exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. And here's the line. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Now, you could tidy this up a little bit into a syllogism and use more rigorous terms, distinguish between innate and externally conditioned desires. But I think the heart of what Lewis is saying here is quite easy to grasp, that there's something in us that desires something which we know this world can't satisfy, and that points us beyond this world. One thing that I sort of left out in the biography of Lewis that you can't really leave out when you're talking about him is his pursuit of joy, this ephemeral grasping of something that just disappears as soon as you think you've got your hands around it. He also called it Sehnsucht. And he would have no doubt recognized this when he read Augustine, who said, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts will wander restless until we rest in you." So that was the argument from desire. And like I said, that one just really resonates within me. He also championed the argument from reason. And I won't say too much about that because back in episode 33, you had Dr. Slagle, and he pulled that apart and showed how naturalism is self-defeating. Lewis wrote about that in Miracles. And put simply, it's just that our knowledge depends on our ability to reason, but reason doesn't really fit in a naturalistic worldview. If what I call my reasoning power is just blindly evolved from non-reasoning matter, if it's just natural selection working with random mutation, if that's the case, why on earth would I trust my mind to bring me to truth? But the last argument that I wanted to look at was the argument for morality. And if you crack open...
David, let me just cut in for a second. I'm going to let you talk about the argument for morality, but I just want to point out that the two that you mentioned already, the argument from desire and the argument from reason, those were actually the two that I found super compelling when I was in college and first got C.S. Lewis. So actually, I was exposed to the argument from desire. Dr. Mm-hmm. Peter Kreeft and Ronald Ticelli have a book out, Handbook of Catholic Apologetics. That was like our weekly meeting group. That was our textbook. Like, we went through that book. And argument desire is like either argument number 16 or 18. I remember it in that book. And at first, you know, I was just trying to understand it. And then when I understood it, the way Dr. Peter Kreeft explained it, I'm like, yeah, this has some force for me. I kind of feel this. And then Miracles, chapter 3, with the argument from reason, that was another one. But those were like the first two, for me, exposures to Lewis's arguments. And I thought they were very good, at least. And if you don't want to see them, I like how you put it. You don't necessarily have to see this as like a deductive metaphysical argument in the vein of St. Thomas Aquinas. These can be pointers. These can be clues. If someone is just thinking that there's no reason at all, there's no evidence for God, well, hey, have you considered this clue, this pointer, that reason doesn't fit with the naturalism, that we have this innate desire for something more? So those two were pretty special to me. So I just wanted to add that, and then I'll let you go into morality.
Yeah, I think Dr. Peter Kreeft, he is the one who really develops the argument from desire in more rigorous philosophical terms. And I also like the way that he couches it in terms of truth, goodness, and beauty, because these are things that we want, and we want them without limit. We're not satisfied with one piece of truth. We want another piece of truth. We're not satisfied with just a little bit of beauty. We want more beauty. And all of these point to that we want infinite truth, goodness, and beauty. And if this is pointing us beyond this world, then that tells us a little bit about the quality of the thing that is beyond this world to which we are being drawn. So the last one I wanted to mention is the argument for morality. And you're going to encounter this if you crack open Mere Christianity. The book itself is divided into four books, and really the entire first book is devoted to this argument for morality. Because one of the things that's really great about Lewis is he doesn't just jump into the Bible said it, therefore you should. He starts on the basis of things that we can agree with. And he actually opens the book by saying, everyone has heard people quarreling. And he says that they say things like, how would you like it if someone did the same to you? Or, that's my seat, I got there first. Or, give me a bit of your orange because I gave you a bit of mine. Or, come on, you promised. And he points out that what's really interesting about this is that the person saying it isn't simply saying that what the other person did doesn't happen to please him. He's appealing to some kind of standard of behavior that he expects the other man to know about. And over the course of Book 1 of Mere Christianity, Lewis examines what's happening here. and that it's pointing to a real right and wrong and a moral law. And he says that some people might try and deny this. And he says that as soon as they try and do this, they might say that right and wrong don't exist in their actions, but they don't say that in their reactions. Basically, as soon as they are wronged, they will be appealing to this moral law. But he then goes on and looks at the possible sources of this moral law. Is it simply personal taste, culture, whatever's convenient to me? Is it just instinct? Is it education? And he shows why each of these is an insufficient explanation for this moral law. And so he draws that book to a conclusion with, well, if there's this moral law, and if we break it regularly, it also implies that there's a moral law giver. And as with most things in classical theism and apologetics in general, you don't have all of the attributes of God, but Lewis uses this as his starting point to build a cumulative case for God, and then specifically the Christian God. And the advantage of this argument, the argument for morality, by arguing that there is a moral law and one that we break, it points us into something else. It points our need for a savior, and therefore the gospel.
That's beautiful. Those are three arguments from C.S. Lewis. He wrote a lot on them, and towards the end, I'm going to ask you for recommendations, David. For, you know, what if people have never read Lewis? What you're going to recommend? But those are great for talking about the existence of God. But I want to move on to our second pillar then. So I love how you just said this kind of points to our need for a savior, because our second pillar at the Classical Theism Podcast is that Jesus is our Lord and Messiah, or you could say Jesus is our Savior. And I know Lewis had a lot to say about this. So what did he do to defend Jesus? And take us into some of those details.
Well, returning to mere Christianity again, at the end of book one, he's concluded that there is this moral law and there's this power behind the moral law. And then as he goes through book two, he looks at what this could be, and he looks at the rival conceptions of God. So he first of all looks at pantheism and looks at why that's incoherent. He looks at dualism, sort of something closer to Zoroastrianism, the idea that there are these two equal and opposite powers in this perpetual battle. One is good and one is evil. And again, he shows why that's an incoherent worldview. And then he eventually brings it all of the way to Jewish monotheism and ultimately Christianity, and about how the God of the Bible has reached out to us, firstly through our sense of conscience, the moral law that we've already talked about, as well as sending the prophets and the good dreams. That's what he calls what he sent to the pagans, the idea of the both the Greek mythology and also later the philosophy, that it was a preparing them for the gospel, and then ultimately the coming of Jesus. And in apologetics, you've got to go to the person of Jesus, because that helps you sort out truth very quickly. Because almost every religion has a statement about who Jesus is. And this is probably the greatest thing that Lewis brought to the conversation, is his trilemma. Again, this didn't come just from him. He was drawing on earlier authors. But again, he popularized it and communicated it in a very pithy way. He says that you really can't say that Jesus is just a good moral teacher and deny his claims to be God. He says that doesn't work. He's either got to be liar, lunatic, or Lord. Either he's lying when he's saying these things, and that is not the impression that you get from the Gospels. Everybody always says he's a very good man. A lunatic, the same thing there. People don't say that this is clearly a madman because of the beautiful wisdom that he has. And so he says that really leaves you with the final option, that he is Lord. But the key point to this argument actually isn't even just to say that Jesus is Lord. It's just saying you cannot say that he's just a great moral teacher and then ignore his claims to divinity. He says, don't let us come with any of that patronizing nonsense. And what's interesting is Lewis actually presents a very similar argument to this in The Chronicles of Narnia. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the youngest child, Lucy, she comes back and she says that she's been to this magical land in the wardrobe. And her older siblings go to the professor of the house, and they're stunned that he actually believes Lucy. And he basically presents the trilemma. He says, well, she clearly isn't mad. You've told me that she is a very truthful child. So until we hear otherwise, let's just assume that she is telling the truth.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that he used that trilemma in Narnia. I got to pick up that series and give it a try. I just have never been a huge fiction reader myself, but it sounds like it would be a lot of fun. And to think that it even has that correspondence to Jesus. I was exposed to the trilemma as well through Dr. Peter Kreeft, and he expands it to the idea of like a quadrilemma, like adding myth mm-hmm. to it. Like that Jesus was a myth. Does Lewis have anything to say against that? Or the idea that Jesus was really more, that the myths developed around him, that it wasn't actually the genuine historical Jesus that's recorded in the New Testament. That might have not been as big of a wave until after Lewis had passed away. Or did he respond to that as you know of?
Yes. As you say, that was more of a response of later writers trying to attack the trilemma by saying, oh, no, there's this fourth option. Lewis didn't address it directly, but it really, how you would answer that today is you would point to textual criticism. And that was actually something that had shocked Lewis while he was still an atheist, when he was having tea with a fellow atheist who commented how good the authenticity and the historical veracity of the Gospels were. He actually commented, it's almost like they really happened. And I think also Lewis's understanding of textual criticism and him being steeped in myth, he says in a couple of places, these don't read like myths. We know what myths sound like and the structure they have, and this isn't it. And today we would say, well, that's because they're Greco-Roman biography, not myth. And probably something else that's worth saying is Lewis is responding to people who say that they believe that Jesus existed. They believe he was a good moral teacher, but deny his divinity. That's the primary force of this argument, to say, no, that's not an option for you. And we could go on to say that myths don't develop within decades. And there's been a lot of research for this. Dr. William Lane Craig, he's done a bunch of stuff on this. And also just other things, like the Gospels contain embarrassing details, like the apostles being very bad apostles. And the first witnesses to the resurrection being women. These are not things that you put into a myth. This sounds much more like reported historical fact.
Well, I'll tell you what, C.S. Lewis, he really got the ball rolling with some high-level stuff, defending the existence of God, talking about Jesus, popularizing this trilemma. But I will say it's still, to this day, people want to try to take the position that he rules out. They just want to say Jesus was a good moral teacher, but you know, not that he was God, not that Christianity was true, he didn't rise from the dead. And they don't want to take the next step. And I think Lewis points out that, well, if you exclude that myth category, if these are reliable accounts of Jesus, you have to take him more seriously than just saying he's a good moral teacher. David, it's great stuff on God and Jesus. But classical theism, I got just a couple more questions for you. So we want to get to classical theism, though, because I know you know, as a listener of this podcast, we don't just focus on God. We focus on the God of classical theism. And I'm curious, do you think Lewis would accept the traditional classical theist view of God? And what makes you think so?
I think so. So classical theism isn't just the belief in an all-knowing, all-powerful, good God, but one who is immanent, transcendent, simple, immutable, impassable, timeless, and a bunch of other things that I'm forgetting. Lewis was steeped in the classics. So Plato, Aristotle, Augustine. So I think it's fairly logical to assume that he was a classical theist, particularly Plato. You find that throughout his works. I was trying to think of some examples of some of these things. I think the strongest one is God's timelessness. In Mere Christianity, Lewis uses this to explain an objection that somebody gave to him, saying, I can believe that God answers prayers, but you know, millions of them at the same time, how does that work? And Lewis presents the fairly classical argument that God is outside of time. And he gives some wonderful analogies. And I'd say that's another real strength of Lewis. He's very good at presenting analogies, pictures to demonstrate what he's trying to explain. Because how do you explain God's eternal now? And what Lewis says is, if you picture time as a straight line along which we have to travel, then you must picture God as the whole page on which the line is drawn. And he says that we come to the different parts of the line bit by bit, you know, A to B to C to D. And he says, but God is above and outside and all around the entire line, and he sees all of it. And Lewis uses this idea multiple times in his works. You actually see it appearing in the Screwtape Letters, and used to also to explain the concept of free will, because God is eternally present when you are making the choice. He explains that some people don't like the idea of God knowing what I'm going to do, but he says, if God sees you doing something, is he also making you do it? And the answer is, well, no, not really. And then he expands that. Well, if God is always present, then you still have freedom, but he also, so to speak, foreknows and foresees because he is present there in the past and in the future.
Very good. Well, hey, Lewis as a classical theist, Lewis as a great fiction writer, Lewis as a Christian convert, as, you know, just all these awesome things. But I got to tell you, David, some people have never read C.S. Lewis, and I'm feeling compelled to read more of them after listening to you today. But suppose a Catholic listening to this has never read C.S. Lewis. They want to pick up two or three titles right away, maybe some summer reading, some fall reading, winter reading, whatever. Where would you suggest they start and why?
Well, one thing that I have noticed among some Catholics is that they're wary to read him because Lewis himself wasn't Catholic. He was a practicing Anglican. But one thing I will say is if you read him, he will sound awfully Catholic to you. And in his life, he believed a lot of things that sound awfully Catholic. He believed in purgatory. He wrote about the sacraments. He called the Eucharist the Blessed Sacrament. He actually went to confession. He believed in praying for the dead. And he read many of the Catholic authors like St. Augustine. And he's actually credited with an awful lot of converts to the Catholic faith. So I would definitely say he's well worth reading. If I had to pick three books, I would say The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Mere Christianity, and The Great Divorce. So I'm picking these for a few reasons. One is that we've spoken about all of these on the podcast. So as you're reading, you could listen along with Matt and myself as we talk about it. But The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because this is an introduction to Narnia. And there's a big hoorah about what order you should read the books in. I'm just going to state you read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first. But you get involved in Lewis's fiction, and you'll start seeing very clearly the Christian motifs that he weaves through his works, the scriptural allusions. And these books are not just for kids. Honestly, I have reread them so many times since I came back to Lewis. There's a lot of richness there and a lot of spiritual food for thought. Second one is Mere Christianity. As I mentioned before, this is probably his most famous apologetic book. And since this is an apologetic podcast, I think that's what your listeners would like. But I'd also say I think it's one of the best introductions to Christianity out there. Out of books that I give to people who are agnostic, atheists, somewhere along the spectrum, Mere Christianity and actually Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic. Those are usually the two books that I tend to give people. And lastly, The Great Divorce. And I recommend this one because it's my favorite. If people haven't read it, Lewis does an imaginative supposal, a what if. He says, what if the souls in hell got to visit heaven for the day and they were invited to actually stay? They were given the option to choose heaven. Would they choose it? And over the course of the book, Lewis does a case-by-case basis as you see these souls come and interact with saints who have come down from the mountain of heaven to the foothills and who try and convince them to come back up and meet God. And we see again and again what people choose instead of heaven. In the book, Lewis says that people always insist on keeping little souvenirs of hell, and they want to bring them with them. But that to embrace heaven means letting those things go, letting those things die so they can be raised again. And I love this book because I think it's beautifully written, but it also really helped me communicate the doctrine of hell to people, because it's one of the very unpopular doctrines of Christianity. But in this book, you get to see why it's necessary. And the fact that either God will say to a person, thy will be done, you can choose to reject me, or the person will say to God, thy will be done, as in your will, not mine. And we get to see a real meditation on the idea of good and evil. And Lewis says that we get to see how our natural affections, even good things like mother love, can be twisted and be distorted and actually even get in the way of our relationship with God. And the Christian journey, this idea of theosis, this being turned into a heavenly creature, is all about the untwisting of our desires and our properly ordering them so that we can be in relationship with God. And if I had to pick one more, I'd probably say the Screwtape Letters as an honorable mention.
Excellent honorable mention. Excellent stuff there. David Bates, thank you so much for joining us on the Classical Theism Podcast. I think the listeners, they can hear your enthusiasm. Check out Pints with Jack. I'm going to be linking to all of David's podcasts, his articles, his speaking. He, folks, you can hear it. You can hear it in his voice. He's an outstanding evangelist. He gives talks on scripture, on apologetics, and you're going to love his podcast on C.S. Lewis. But David, please just tell us, where can listeners go to find out more about your work? And then we'll say goodbye.
My personal blog is restlesspilgrim.net. The website for the podcast itself is pintswithjack.com. There you'll also find the YouTube channel, and Matt and I recorded a 13-part series on Lewis's thought in Mere Christianity. They're nice short videos, so they're a nice entry into the world of C.S. Lewis. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We are on Pints with Jack. And on these channels, you can find out what we're up to. And several times a week, I post quotations that I've put together in graphic form, because there are a lot of incorrect C.S. Lewis quotations that get passed around the internet. So I decided to start fighting back. And it's also a way of learning some of Lewis's very pithy little statements. And if any listeners want to start a reading group, reach out. I'd love to help support you in that. I've got some materials that and discussion questions and little outlines. But yeah, the purpose of our podcast is to get people to read Lewis, because we think he's well worth reading. And particularly for your listeners, he was an excellent apologist. But he was also someone who also realized the dangers of apologetics insofar as how we can become prideful. And Lewis is a wonderful example of the humble apologist. He wrote the Apologist's Evening Prayer. And he said, "From cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, O God, at which will angels weep, the audience laugh. From all my proofs of thy divinity, thou, who wouldst give no sign, deliver me." So I think Lewis is an excellent example of a humble apologist that would be well worthy of emulation.
That is just great stuff, David. Thank you so much. I will be linking to all of that in the show notes page. And thanks again for coming on the Classical Theism Podcast.
You're welcome. It was lovely. It was like when you're first invited to the grown-ups table.
Well, you belong at this table, I'll tell you that much.
Thank you very much.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that interview with David Bates. The show notes page is jam-packed with works of C.S. Lewis and links to what David just mentioned, his podcast and his blog. So if you want to get started reading Lewis, I really recommend, I follow David's recommendations there. You're going to find a lot of good apologetics material and just examples and illustrations for explaining the faith in general. So show notes page for this episode, you can find all that stuff at classicaltheism.com/Bates, B-A-T-E-S. That's how you spell David's name. So classicaltheism.com/Bates. I really appreciate you spending the time here this week with me to learn some apologetics in C.S. Lewis. We're defending the core pillars of the Catholic Christian faith. And, you know, it's 45 minutes. It's an hour. You are putting in this time, but I hope this is going to be time well worth it, because the next time you're in a conversation with someone, you're going to have something to offer that they may not have considered, especially if it's somebody shouting at you saying, "There's no evidence for God." All right. So I hope you got some good information out of this episode. I hope you're having a great week. And please know that I'm praying for you. I know. That was the song Fight by Jonna Marie. You can find out more of her work over at classicaltheism.com/music.